For the week of June 6th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 57, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And at the Apple Store, already in line for a new iPhone, I'm Michael Giltz.
Michael, you must make a lot of money because you're buying an awful lot of technology.
Actually, no, I was actually in flight. I just arrived back in America from London, so I don't even know. I wasn't able to watch the launch for the iPhone. Does it look cool?
We think you're really going to love it.
What's neat about it?
Okay, that was supposed to be like a Steve Jobs joke. But it's got 100 new features on it. But we'll tell you now about the 8 we're most excited about. It's got iMovie on it. How could you hate it?
Mm-hmm.
You can shoot and edit your movie all on your phone. Things you never thought you wanted to do until Steve Jobs told you you wanted to do them.
Well, Flip Video told me that, but apparently he doesn't want them to tell you to do it. He wants to do it himself.
Yeah, basically what he was saying to Flip Video was...
Flip you.
Yeah, exactly. And I look forward to seeing it.
Is it a must get, or is it just another step up, or does it feel like, wow, I really, really want this too?
It really does feel like an advancement.
Wow.
But we should probably get on with the news here. It was kind of a slow news week in the entertainment world, and in a minute, we'll see just how slow when, Michael, you fill us in on all of the box office grosses. We'll also be joined shortly by Carl DiIorio, the deputy film editor at The Hollywood Reporter, who wrote a piece last week about why the summer box office may be in a bit of a rut. The MTV Movie Awards were held last night, and we'll cover all the big winners and losers and try to do so with as few profane words as possible. In television news, we'll talk about some reality shows on Bravo, as well as a few actors from a hit sitcom who want a 285% pay raise. I'd like a 285. You know what? I'll take a 200% pay raise. In our lightning round, Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll go over some of the week's top news stories, including why, after making a fortune on Avatar, director James Cameron finds himself underwater. And during Inside Baseball, we'll update you on the chaos going on over the ownership of a couple of indie studios. But as always, first, we hand it over to Michael Giltz, who will fill us in on the North American box office.
Yes, I'm really an expert on the British box office. I did go to the movies this weekend, but it was to see a small British film called Four Lions, which hopefully we'll get to talk about because it was great. A very funny comedy about would-be jihadi terrorists, sort of hapless fellows in London, a black comedy. And it sounds crazy, and it was really good. But here in America, I haven't seen anything in for weeks, and apparently no one else has either. Number one at the box office was Shrek Forever After with $25.3 million. It's number one for the third weekend in a row. It's made a total of $183 million so far in the U.S., and it hasn't really launched in a lot of places overseas because of World Cup. Number two was Get Him to the Greek at $17.4 million. It's sort of a spinoff from Forgetting Sarah Marshall, not that anybody would know that, starring the bizarrely popular British comic Russell Brand. And number three was Killers, a film very similar to Night and Day, coming up with Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz. This one stars, help me out, folks.
Katie Heigl, Catherine Heigl, and Ashton Kutcher.
That's $16.1 million. Not an awful opening, not a great opening, which is sort of the story of the week. Number four, Prince of Persia, still above $10 million. It made $13.9 million. It's at $59 million so far in the U.S. And number five is Sex and the City 2 at $12.6 million. That's at $73 million, well off the pace of the first one. Number six, Marmaduke, which opened to $11.3 million. And then Iron Man 2 is approaching $300 million. It's at $291 million. Splice, a horror film, which got some pretty good reviews, is at $7.4 million, so it didn't open. Robin Hood is trying desperately to reach $100 million in the U.S. And Letters to Juliet is chugging along at $3 million in number 10. So really the big news is overseas, where I was all week. Movies like Robin Hood grossing, you know, 1.5 times as much. It's grossed how much? $172 million overseas compared to barely $100 million in the U.S. Prince of Persia has grossed 3 times as much overseas than it has in the U.S. It's at $156 million overseas. So it's at $210 million total. But I mean, none of that should be surprising, right? I mean, what's amazing to me is that movies don't gross 10 times as much because there are only 300 million people in the U.S. and there's 6 billion people in the rest of the world. So there's a lot of business that still isn't being made overseas. Something like Iron Man 2 and Prince of Persia and all these movies, they should be making 10 times overseas if we were properly screened, shouldn't they, Sperling?
Well, yes. I mean, over the last 10 to 15 years, I would say international box office has come to about 60% of a film's total gross. So 40% would be earned in North America, 60% overseas. And so
it should be 80-20 if it's a big international movie.
Well, remember, not all.
If it's a big blockbuster.
Well, remember, these are American movies, so not they don't play as well necessarily in all territories. Not all of them play. Like Sex and the City 2 probably won't play as well in India as it does in New York City.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, that actually I would argue, but I mean,
that's true. That's probably a poor example. Reasons.
But no. But yeah, when we're talking about a big blockbuster movie like Shrek Forever After and Prince of Persia, these are movies designed to play all over the world. Iron Man 2. It just seems like they should be making sometimes 90% of their money overseas. Why not? There's 20 times as many people in the rest of the world as there are in the U.S. It seems like the future can only get better for movies like this.
5 weeks into the summer box office season, the total ticket sales revenue is down 4%, which is interesting. And I should say it's down 4% over the same period a year ago. And what's interesting about it is that there was a 6% rise in ticket prices. So that means far fewer people are going to the movies. And we're going to get Carl DiIorio from The Hollywood Reporter on here in a moment just to explain maybe why that is. Movie attendance seems to be down 10% year over year.
But I mean, that's sort of natural, right? I mean, last year was a record year.
It was a record year, but
caught up in these year-to-year things, but it's like, yeah, there's ups and downs. There's good seasons and bad seasons, good movies and bad movies. But if you take a step back and look at a 5-year, 10-year span, I mean, every year can't grow over the year before.
It seems to me like we change our minds on this, like, every podcast. Sometimes attendance is way up, and sometimes it's really shockingly low.
Well, you know what I think it is that you're 4% down, yet your prices are 6% higher, which means that you're really, 10% down in terms of the
actual ticket sales.
Actual ticket sales. Why don't we get Carl on and see what he has to say about this? Okay, just dial up Carl here. Hello, Carl?
Yes, hello.
Hi, joining us from the newsroom at The Hollywood Reporter. You are the deputy film editor there, and I have Michael Giltz and Karen Woodward, our two co-hosts, on with us.
Hi, Carl.
Hi, guys.
And we were just talking about this week's box office, or lack thereof, and why it seems to be down about 10%, or at least attendance is down 10% year over year. And you wrote an interesting piece for The Hollywood Reporter called "Are Moviegoers Tiring of Sequels?" What was your finding in that?
The early summer box office season has been rather underwhelming, and coincidence or not, it's been marked by underperforming sequels or franchise installments of one sort or another. Shrek Forever After was actually a third sequel, so a fourth in a franchise, and it's going to do $250 million domestically eventually, so it's hard to not give them their props in terms of being able to ring up a lot of money. And yet, if one considers then additionally that it is going to do less business than either of its previous franchise predecessors, Shrek the Third or Shrek Two, one does, take notice. Add in the fact that Sex and the City 2 opened well under what anybody had anticipated. And by the way, Shrek Forever After opened a good $30 million lower than what people were hoping for over its opening weekend. So these are pictures that look as $100, $200 million productions. Summer tentpoles are supposed to make a lot of money. When they don't reach expectations, then you're left with the question, well, is this just a function of expectations management went awry, or is there something lacking here? And people are starting to scratch their heads and say, I wonder if what's lacking is a little bit of originality in the theater.
But then Prince of Persia was original, and it didn't do that well at all.
Yeah. You really wouldn't offer that as Exhibit A for what original concepts can do. But, is it also relevant then, and I just offer this as grist for the discussion, is it also relevant that you have a picture that clearly they were hoping to start a franchise with? It was Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time. So clearly planned as first in a series of, forgive me, but somewhat formulaic action adventure pictures of the tentpole variety. This is how development executives and producers think in the summer season these days. If we do this, that, and the other thing and cast it in a certain way, are these pictures that can begin a multiple installment franchise?
Well, now you point out that 11 sequels will open in the May-August span, and that another one of them, that's the one that started the summer season, was Iron Man 2, also performed disappointingly.
And yet, again, we have to give them their props. Iron Man's going to get the $300 million domestically. So that just goes to show the very high-priced neighborhood we're playing in here. If you spend $200 million to make a movie, you want to, these days, do $300 million or better. And by the way, we're only now a week away from the launch of two pictures that, if early tracking is any indication, very well could stimulate the market in a way that we haven't seen for a while. And ironically, they're one of them adaptation of a big screen adaptation of a 1980s TV series, The A-Team, and the other is a remake of the 1970s picture and sequel generator, Karate Kid. So once again, we have a couple pictures that are not original concepts, but in this instance, going into the weekend at this point, it looks like each one could make about $30 million over its opening weekend. So those aren't eye-popping numbers, but when you get two $30 million openings on one weekend for $60 million between just two pictures, people are hoping that's going to begin to get the summer box office market healthy again.
And of course, everybody's eyes are on one particular film to really, not maybe set records, but certainly bring in over $100 million on its opening.
I'm guessing you're talking about a threequel, Toy Story 3.
Okay, I wasn't talking about that, but I was talking about Twilight, although thank you very much. Yes, that will do it as well.
Well, I tell you, Sperling, Twilight Eclipse, so another threequel, or a third in a franchise, second sequel, which for people that, you know, either aren't accustomed to or despise words like threequels, let me say that. That's another interesting proposition. Eclipse is probably tracking at this point for like $125 million over its first weekend. And that sounds like a tremendous amount of money until you go back and look at what New Moon, the first sequel in the Twilight franchise, did. That did $148 million. So again, it's all about the expectations. And, you know, maybe we've just become a little bit jaded, people who do our job. But if you don't match the opening performance of the franchise installment that came previously, I don't know how that stimulates must-see interest. Now, when you said it wasn't Toy Story 3, which is supposed to do fabulously, I thought that maybe you were going to say Inception, because now Inception is a very original concept, kind of an adventure fantasy type sci-fi picture.
From the director of The Dark Knight, Chris Nolan.
Yes, indeed, Chris Nolan. And I'll tell you, I don't know if you've picked up on this kind of buzz, but the somewhat, you know, hyperbolic buzz coming out of Warner Brothers is they think it's going to be the event picture of the summer.
It probably could be if it, you know, if it's any good.
Exactly. But
yeah, I think one thing that everybody noticed when they looked at the summer box office and why movies weren't doing well is, of course, all the movies we're talking about that came out got bad reviews. They got mixed to poor reviews, so they shouldn't do well at the box office.
Well, that's what you run into when you try to do these sorts of analysis. There is the obvious alternate explanation of, well, you know, the pictures kind of sucked.
And there, of course, there are a lot of other movies we haven't even mentioned yet and coming out this summer, like Night and Day, the Tom Cruise film, The Last Airbender, which is based on a very cool TV show, Salt.
Yeah, Pray, Love. You know, those are all probably going to be, I'll be surprised if multiple of those movies that you mentioned don't work. Night and Day is supposed to be huge. We'll see. But it is early to be characterizing the summer in any given way. But I would say this additionally. If we remember that these are studios that are now owned by publicly traded conglomerates, they have year-over-year summer comparisons. And the industry as a whole tends to rate the healthiness of the theatrical marketplace by comparisons with previous summers. So even a percentage impact from an over-reliance on sequels, you know, arguably is something you need to pay attention to.
And I think that's exactly what's happening. They are over-relying on sequels and known entities, and people are just getting tired of it.
I won't speak for the public, but I think one can make that argument.
But now one of the things we were talking about just before giving you a call was the fact that international is doing so well. All of these films are doing well internationally. Robin Hood, Prince of Persia have done three times what they've done, or two to three times what they've done here in the United States and Canada. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's for two reasons. International theatrical audience as a whole tends to be a lot more accepting of very broad stroke formulaic action pictures of the sort that you get in the summer. So they're... an easy audience to market to. Secondly, the international audience is ever expanding because there's marketplaces like Russia and China that are now huge and didn't used to exist, either because of a low installed base of decent theatrical infrastructure or because of piracy that they're starting to come to grips with in some of these growing marketplaces. But just to show you that a studio executive's glass is just never half full, what they're saying about the undeniably positive foreign marketplace this summer is that, gee whiz, wouldn't it be better if the euro currency conversion were not so lousy right now?
Well, it's not. Well, it depends on what you consider lousy.
Yeah. I just got back from London and I was about the euro and the pound falling.
Yeah.
You know, it's great for travelers. Not so great when you convert your box office back into UN's currency.
Good point.
I'm glad you talked about the international box office because I'm a big believer. We're a big believer at Showbiz Sandbox and taking the big picture and saying, hey, you've got to look at the international gross. You've got to look at DVD sales before you label a film a flop or a success. You've got to look at the whole picture and what it grosses. But there is a worrying trend that we have, and I think it's a little concerning to see increasing ticket prices and decreasing attendance. You know, they've got the 3D premium glasses. They've got higher ticket prices. Some theaters in New York were charging $20 for tickets to movies, and that got a ton of bad press. And I think that really turns people off and makes them think movies are too expensive. And then when you've got lower, you know, actual attendance figures, that's just not a good trend for movies to have.
The executives are definitely worried about that. This weekend, nobody seemed to have a clear answer as to why we had one more underperforming weekend. They were asking me what I thought. And, you know, when I just kind of mumbled a few things, their reply was, geez, do you think it could be that word of mouth on ticket prices has gotten so bad because of one or two 3D pictures that it spoiled it for everybody else? I was kind of surprised when even a studio executive said that to me. But your point about the DVD revenue and the overseas revenue and the picture being much more complicated than sometimes we are inclined to account for, you make an excellent point. I mean, that's why at green lighting meetings anymore, they've got the home entertainment executives at the table. They've got the international distribution guy right there. And before they even green light pictures, they want those executives to project what they think a particular script would ultimately generate overseas or on DVD.
Well, certainly there's a lot of summer left and we'll see how it plays out, but in the meantime, we thank you for taking the time to join us and fill us in on what's going on or what's not going on with the North American box office.
Thank you. We love to chat like this, and thanks for calling.
Oh, our pleasure. Thanks.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Thanks a lot. Well, that was a lot of fun for Carl to talk to us. I appreciate him stopping by. It's it's fun because we talk about, oh my God, the summer box office is not going well. And then we're listing about 10 movies that look like they're surefire smash hits coming up in the weeks to come. So it'll be fun to see where we end up. But clearly, when you've got a bunch of sequels and they're not done well, that's just not a good sign. But Toy Story 3 will be done well.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's very good. It's worth seeing. It's a lot of fun. I was surprised that they were able to capture the essence of the first and second films.
I can't wait.
Karen, are you going to see Toy Story 3?
It's a Toon. She hates Toontown.
That would be no. You know, there really aren't that many movies that I'm excited about. I'm interested to see Inception, and I will definitely see Salt, unless it gets terrible reviews. But there's really nothing else that I can say I'm excited to see.
You know, I saw Shrek 4 or Shrek Forever After, Shrek the Final Chapter this week, and it was pretty good. I saw it over the weekend. Theater was packed. It was a 10 o'clock screening, and the theater was packed with families. There were 12 trailers ahead of the film, and that was after the advertisements. And
I'm assuming you mean 10 a.m., not 10 p.m., right?
Yes, 10 a.m., yes. And I just thought, you know, 12 trailers? People were laughing by like the 10th or 11th trailer. And by the 12th trailer, people were getting angry.
Well, that's just, I always think that they should, you know, they can run all those things that they want, but just have the movie start at a certain time.
Right.
You know,
I agree.
Should have a continuous, I don't know why they ever have a dark screen and do the stupid postcards. Show trailers from the end of one movie to the beginning of the next, as far as I'm concerned, but don't make us sit there for 20 minutes when the movie's supposed to start and watch them.
You know, I saw was...
I would never leave the theater if they did that. I love trailers sometimes more than the movies themselves.
Oh, well, it's funny you should mention that. I'm going to the Golden Trailer Awards this week with Steven Garrett, as a matter of fact, Michael.
Are you his date?
I'm not his date, actually. We got credentialed.
But we'll be rooting for him because his company, which is called...
Kinetic.
Is up for a lot of awards, as always. So they're sure to have another great year at the Golden Trailer Awards.
Yes, he edits trailers. And speaking of trailers, I saw the 3D version of The Last Airbender, and I can tell you it looks better than Clash of the Titans, though not by much.
Ooh. Karen, do you not want to see Eat, Pray, Love, the Julia Roberts film?
No desire. Hated the book.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I don't want to. I couldn't read the book. It just the back cover made me get creepy crawly.
I was so intensely bored, and I wonder if that makes me a bad person because there are so many women that I know who are like, this book changed my life. And they're like, I got maybe 50 pages. I'm like, this is a boring piece of crap.
It makes you a woman who doesn't belong in L.A.
Yes, we'll get you on the next bus. But not before you tell us what you thought of the MTV Movie Awards last night. Or should I say, what you effing thought of the effing MTV Movie Awards last night. Certainly, speaking of... Yeah, well, you know, the Twilight was a big winner. So Twilight Eclipse is coming out shortly. And Twilight, I think, won, let's see, counting the Best Kiss and, well, everything, actually. Also, 3D got bashed by The Host. Did you watch? Now, Michael, I assume you didn't watch it since you were flying, but Karen, did you watch it?
I didn't watch it in real time, but I watched the clips afterwards. So I saw J-Lo dancing with Tom Cruise.
Les
Grossman, whatever the name. Yeah, his character from Tropic Thunder. And although a lot of people on Facebook were thinking it was really silly, I thought it was kind of funny.
And I'll tell you
and
something.
And who knew that Tom Cruise had such moves?
He was unbelievable.
He's a better dancer than I am.
As he was dancing, I thought to myself, wow, he is actually making a career comeback with Jennifer Lopez, of all people.
Who needs a career comeback as well. So in a way, it was almost sort of sad. But And I watched the Best Kiss clip with Rob Pattinson and Kristen Stewart because I'm always a sucker for the Best Kiss clip. And... it never disappoints.
Yeah, they were so awkward together, and she just cannot. I mean,
that
she
was the point. They did that on purpose.
Oh, okay. Because I was when she won her award, she was just she is so camera shy and stage shy, and it was
very awkward.
It was so awkward. I felt embarrassed for her. I mean, it was she can't talk unless somebody puts a script in her mouth. I mean, it's
yeah. I get nervous watching her interviews.
Did you want to protect her from werewolves and vampires, and just put your arm around her and keep her safe?
No, you would, Sperling.
No, I would like to feed her to a werewolf so I don't have to watch her anymore.
Oh.
Oh.
What'd you think of the Sandra Bullock bit? She got received, I guess, a Lifetime Achievement Award or a Outstanding Everything Award.
A Generation Award.
Yeah. Which, you know, I'm not really... I thought it was good what she did. I thought she handled herself quite well, and Betty White was there, and she, you know, said a few nice words about Sandra Bullock, and then what's his name?
Bradley Cooper.
Yeah, he said a few nice words. And then Scarlett Johansson was also there, and for like no reason at all. She didn't say anything nice about her, and it was kind of weird, and to the point where Sandra Bullock turned around and said, "I'm sorry, Scarlett, why are you here?" And they wound up kissing for some reason.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, it was just very awkward. That it was, I don't know, just weird.
Anyway. That sounds awesome.
Oh, well, I find the MTV I almost said MTV Music Awards. I find the MTV Movie Awards to be trivial at best. I mean, who cares who wins those things?
Nobody.
Oh my God, I totally do.
No way.
I totally do. I find those more relevant to popular culture than the Academy Awards. No question of that.
No, who won last year?
Twilight, I think.
Twilight, yeah. There you go, popular culture.
Yeah, no, there nobody cares who wins. It's supposed to be a fun show.
Yeah, it's such a fun show that they had like Christina Aguilera and Katy Perry on, two music folks who...
Did they kiss?
They did not kiss.
No, who cares?
But anyway, Russell Brand was gazing adoringly. There's something really rather sweet about it.
Yes.
Oh my God.
But what do those
when
two...
When did I turn into a girl?
When did those two have to do with anything having to do with movies? Why were they there?
I'm sure because their songs have been used in movies. Come on. Anyway.
Yeah, come on, they're pop culture people.
Should we talk about Comcast and DreamWorks and their little...
We should probably skip it. I read it and it's actually not giving you...
Well, we should move on. Come on.
Yeah, okay. Well, we can move on to actually Karen's favorite topic, although...
TV!
It's kind of related to TV and it's kind of related to pop culture. It's about reality television and it's about... There was an article in the New York Times about Bethany getting married. Now, just so you know, I had no idea what this show was about, and I guess it hasn't really aired yet, but I had no idea who Bethany Frankel was.
What?
Or that there was even a show called The Real Housewives of New York, but apparently...
You knew that. What? You knew there was a show called The Real Housewives.
Okay, yes, but I didn't know they had made it to New York. I thought they were in Atlanta and Orange County and Laguna Hills and...
No, they went to New York, like, the second season.
Okay, what do
Bitch,
I...
the New York was the best.
Well,
I'm really concerned.
Well, apparently this Bethany Frankel was a huge hit, and so they're giving her her own show, which premieres Thursday night.
Covers her marriage, or yeah. Her wedding, right?
Yeah, well, the show will track her surprise pregnancy, which I'm not quite sure how you have a surprise pregnancy when, you know, were you there? Her baby's birth and her wedding.
In that order.
Yes. That is correct.
So why is this interesting? Why are we talking about this?
Because the article was pointing out that Bravo will make you a star if the web agrees. And they were talking about this Bravo Liberty, which is what they call these spin-off reality shows where they have something like The Real Housewives of New York and then there's a breakout star and so they take that person and give them their own show.
Yeah, which everybody does.
But how do they determine the breakout star? They study like social media and you know what people are saying online, and then they say, well, we're going to make a show about this person, and they make a whole study out of it.
Yeah,
and it's not just who they like most. I assume it's who people talk about the most, right? Because you can have a villainess that would deserve
exactly.
their own show.
You don't
right?
have to like the person exactly.
Yeah, and what I'm not surprised at this because I knew they kind of did this, but they will actually start rewriting the show, even though it's reality, quote unquote, based on what their polls say, based on what is being said on Twitter and on Facebook and in their own. Yeah. I'm sorry?
You focus the show on whoever's the breakout star, right?
Or
if you find
not necessarily, because some of their shows, the people have been voted off early in the season, and yet they still were voted as, you know, most popular of the show or whatever, and then they can go on and get their own show.
And yeah. It's just another smart use of social media for TV networks and film people to study who deserves to have their own show, what elements work, what elements don't.
It's just so clinical. I guess none of this should surprise us, but what did surprise me was that they were so upfront about how clinical it is, because not only do they study what their people are saying social media, but they study their own demographics and they say, okay, well, we've got women in this age group and they're affluent, so let's make a show that's going to be geared towards them. And then we've got a whole other age bracket, you know, over here, and then let's make a show just for them. There's no thought of creativity or anything like that. It's like a factory.
Well, and they
none of this should surprise us.
And then they actually turn around and say, listen, you reality folks who are on The Real Housewives of Insert City here, they ask them to blog, they ask them to be on Twitter. So they're promoting it not only with their own Twitter accounts, Bravo, you know, at Bravo or whatever the Bravo Twitter account is, but also through the people who are on it, so that you have all these like multiple social media tentacles reaching out into the world and trying to grab audience.
Yeah, you know, American Idol got a little scared with that. This season, they had all the contestants in the top 24 had a Twitter account. And I was all excited about following them and seeing how many followers they got and seeing who was using Twitter smartly and saying funny, smart things to build an audience. But they sort of panicked and pulled the plug on it and had them all just sort of back off from that. They started to do it a little bit, but then they just stopped it completely. I don't know what happened.
Do we know why?
I think they just... Suddenly, I think they realized you'd be able to track and see who was really popular. That was my guess, was that they said, uh-oh, this, you know, they don't release sales of singles. They don't, you know, they keep a lot of things secret so that people can't track who's wildly popular. I think to their detriment, if people realized there was a horse race this year between Lee DeWise and Crystal Bower Sox, they might have been more fascinated. So they only should worry about it if it's a runaway, you know, train that's crushing everyone in their path. But I think they were worried people would just know too much by seeing who had the most fans. Or they were worried they couldn't control them enough and that they would just Twitter whatever they wanted. So I signed up to all their accounts. And
I'm sure it was probably both.
Yeah, it was all bogus.
Well, a show that is both original and has a lot of fans is The Big Bang Theory. However, and this is a sitcom that airs on CBS, and it stars Johnny Galecki, Kaylee Cuoco, is that how you pronounce it?
Cuoco.
And Jim Parsons, all of whom would like... a 285% raise.
I mean, this is the biggest new sitcom since probably Two and a Half Men. I mean, really, it's much bigger than The Office, much bigger than 30 Rock, much bigger than any other sitcom on any other network. This is the big sitcom of you know the last 5 years, so they deserve to have a huge raise.
Well, they're looking to go for, by the way, Forbes agrees with you, which is where this story comes from, and I'll get to that in a second.
Thank you, Forbes. I haven't read any show notes, so...
They are, the actors, that is, want to go from $65,000 per episode to...
Pennies, peanuts. How can they even feed their children?
Well, they are children, so they don't necessarily have any yet. But they want $250,000 a show.
That's not a lot.
That's actually a lot of money.
Well, it sounds like a lot of money until you find out that a couple things. One, how much was it that Charlie Sheen wanted? Was it like $2 million?
Yeah, getting like two or three.
Yeah, $2 million an episode?
That was year 12 of the series. This is the time. This is season 3 of the show?
Yes.
Oh, right. No. This is when
they should racket it up. This is the right time, and they're doing it as a group like the Friends. Friends was very smart. They said they grouped together, and they said nobody's a star, nobody's supporting. We're all going to be together, all get the same price. I think that was a really smart thing. And these three people are grouped together all to get the same amount. It keeps backbiting down to a minimum, keeps somebody getting more, you know, it just is a very smart way to approach it. It's the right time to do it. And then they'll be locked in for the next 4 or 5 years.
Well, and it's funny you should mention all of those things, Michael, because what Forbes is saying is here are the four reasons that they believe that the Big Bang stars deserve a raise and will get it. The first one is the show gets spectacular ratings. As you mentioned, it's ranked 8th among scripted shows with 14.3 million people on average watching it. The second reason is CBS believes in the series so much that they are moving it from its Monday night time slot to Thursday night, where it will anchor a whole bunch of untried and untested shows. The third reason is the show is a hit with viewers and critics, generating both buzz publicly and critical acclaim, i.e. awards. And finally... I think it's finally. The syndication for this particular show is only 15 months away, where some experts put the value of each episode at $2 million. And
right.
Here's the last one. Lofty goals for the show. Here's what Warner Brothers domestic television distribution president, that's a mouthful, his name is Ken Werner, and he put the series in a category with comedy giants like Friends or Seinfeld and Everybody Loves Raymond, all of whom went through their little salary problems at some point in time. He says, quote, "The Big Bang Theory presents an increasingly rare proposition for broadcast stations and cable services, the chance to acquire traditional multi-camera A-tier comedy that is still expanding its audience on network television and which is poised for continued growth in future seasons, making it an asset that will only increase in value for Fox and TBS for years to come. And what he's saying is, hey, if you guys purchase this show in syndication, it's only going to have a bigger and bigger and bigger audience. So looking at that and seeing that the stars want more money, yeah, it all makes sense. The stars deserve more money.
Yeah, it's a half a billion to $1 billion property, ultimately. Once all is said and done, as far as the number of episodes they make and the money they're going to make on air, reruns, and in syndication on DVD, it's easily probably a $1 billion property. So this is their only time to make money. Yeah, and, Thursday night at 8 o'clock, it's going to crush Community. No one's going to watch Community when they've got the Big Bang Theory opposite. It's really going to hurt NBC. NBC's been so weak with their lineup on Thursday nights. This is going to kill them.
And there are very few shows on television today that make it to 100 episodes and can go into syndication. And so if each show is worth $2 million, I mean, that's a big deal.
Well, this is the... Oh.
That's a big segue.
Yes, it is.
Because I would say that's, this is a rare multi-format sitcom hit. There aren't a lot of those anymore. So it's not that every show does it. This is a rare bird these days.
A rare bird. That's, I think you've spent way too much time in London.
Oh, never mind.
I know, Michael's working on like 2 hours of sleep after flying for hours and hours and hours. How long were you in the air?
Oh, it's not a big deal. I'm fine.
Okay, well, with that note, it's time for our lightning round, our ever-popular segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first news story is about James Cameron, who seems to be diving deep into the Gulf oil spill. He met with a whole bunch of leading minds in deep undersea engineering and but a whole bunch of really smart people who spend a lot of time underwater. And you'd think, what the heck is he doing? Shouldn't he be making movies, not trying to stop some oil spill? Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, what did he do? Did he come up with some action plan for dealing with the spill, or what did they really, did they, what was the purpose of the meeting? Well, I mean, we know he's been for years working on deep sea filming underwater and filming Titanic, and he's been really involved in undersea exploration for the last 10, 12, 15 years. So I'm not surprised he would know all those people, but what did they do?
Well, he met last Tuesday with some big deep sea minds and created a memo that was signed by all the participants, and he believes that 70% of the world's deep sea engineering and diving expertise was present, and He provided this memo to the Coast Guard and other agencies overseeing BP's effort to stanch the seabed gusher. However, in the midst of it, he said, he was speaking at the All Things D conference in New York, and he said, quote, "Over the last few weeks, I've watched, as we all have, with growing horror and heartache, watching what's happening in the Gulf and thinking, those morons don't know what they're doing." And that was completely taken out of context, because what he was saying is, look, I initially started watching that way, and then I realized just how hard this really is.
So was the memo, I'm still confused about what they did. Did the memo say, here's what they should be doing, or we support them, or what?
He hasn't made that public yet.
It's a big whoop, I guess.
Karen?
This is a big whoop! Oh my God! It resulted in a memo? Who cares? Go talk to Kevin Costner. He's like got some kind of a, like, Kevin Costner's like invented some machine that separates water and oil. That's the big deal. Care about James Cameron's memo, for Christ's sake.
He's sending the Navi down just to cap the oil spill or something. That would be a big deal. All right.
Our next story is about singer Mariah Carey, who has dropped out of Tyler Perry's latest movie, an adaptation of the 1975 play for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. Less than a week before filming was to begin, she dropped out. Director Tyler Perry had to cut his vacation short to find a replacement, and he chose Thandi Newton to replace her, and she will join Whoopi Goldberg, Kerry Washington, and Janet Jackson in the cast. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
I suppose it's a big deal for her or for Tyler Perry if he had to, mess up his vacation, but ultimately it's a big whoop. I mean, this kind of thing happens all the time. Maybe she's pregnant. You heard it here first!
Why did she drop out?
Well, the speculation is that she might be pregnant. She said, and this is Tyler Perry writing somewhere. I couldn't figure out where. This was a story from CNN. I was told, and this is a quote, I was told that we got a call saying that even though our deal was done, she had been advised by her doctor not to do the film. I said,
What?
You know I want a doctor's note, don't you? LOL.
I say it's a big deal for Mariah Carey because, you know, she had a very modest role in Precious, but she was good and she got a lot of nice notice. So if this is a really prestigious project, it's Tyler Perry. It's an acclaimed play. It's clearly his big bid for to be taken seriously as a director. It's not one of his usual movies. It's a really, you know, it's an acclaimed play from the 70s that, you know, I'm sure people have been trying to get into the big screen for years. It's a big cast. So it would have been a real chance for her to solidify her comeback as an actress. So I say it's a big deal.
Well, moving on, we're going to move on to producer Marshall Herskovitz, who is warning of devaluing content. Speaking at the Produce By conference, the producer of such films as The Last Samurai and Blood Diamonds, as well as television shows such as 30-something, said, quote, "Everything you make is available everywhere and hence has less intrinsic value. I don't have a solution for it." Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. If you had a solution, it'd be a big deal.
Karen?
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Sorry.
Okay. Then
we've got a James Cameron memo on our hands here. Tell me when you've got some solutions.
He literally didn't tell people what they decided. They met, they discussed, and wouldn't tell them what they figured out.
And the result was a memo.
That he won't release.
Well, maybe Don Cheadle will write a few memos because he's going to be a UN spokesperson. He was appointed Saturday in Rwanda's capital as a UN Environment Program Goodwill Ambassador and vowed to fight climate change and promote environment conservation. He'll probably do so through a memo. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's nice that he's doing it and using his celebrity for useful, positive issues.
Karen?
Yeah, big whoop. Big pat in the back, Don.
Okay, then. I guess we'll move on to Jeremy Renner, who is near a deal to join Marvel's Avenger, the Hurt Locker actor, is in final negotiations to join the Avengers, Marvel Studios' big screen take on its superhero team that's being directed by Joss Whedon. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal for his career. Good for him.
Michael?
It's a big deal. I'd like to take the entire cast out for a drink. Robert Downey Jr., Chris Hemsworth, Chris Evans, Scarlett Johansson, Jeremy Renner. This is going to be a fun night on the town.
Yeah, Renner will play Hawkeye. And of course, Robert Downey Jr. is going to play Iron Man Tony Stark. And Hemsworth is going to be Thor. Chris Evans is going to be Captain America. Scarlett Johansson is going to be the Black Widow. And Samuel L. Jackson will be Nick Fury. Don Cheadle will show up as War Machine.
Is that part of fighting the environment, being a war machine?
When he's not fighting the environment.
Oh, brother. That's a sure sign we should move on to the fact that apparently the reason that American Idol ratings are down this year is because Judge Ellen DeGeneres is gay, or so says a Christian news site, which is making headlines by claiming Ellen is responsible for the ratings erosion of Fox's American Idol. The Christian Newswire director, Gary McCulloch, says the sexual orientation of the newest Idol judge was the reason Idol ratings were down about 9% this season. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop because the show's been on the air for 9 years, so being the number one show in the country and dropping modestly in the ratings is not a sign of taking a hit. That was the remarkable thing about the show this season. Ellen made a number of comments about her partner or woman or being gay. Somebody sang, at one point, I think Lita Wise or somebody sang, "Have You Ever Loved a Woman?" the Bryan Adams song. And on her review of it, she said, "Actually, you know, have I ever loved a woman? Yes, I have." And everybody laughed and she just went on and you thought, wow, that's a new world. And that's what drives those people nuts. The fact that everybody just smiled and laughed and went on with the show and nobody thought twice about it. It was just a very natural part of the show. So it's clearly not the reason the show is hurting in the ratings, because it's not. It's the number one show in the country.
Well, to your point, Michael, Gary McCulloch said, quote, "At this moment in entertainment history, network television is on a pro-homosexuality bender. Perhaps next we will see the pro-pedophilia group NAMBLA use its influence in Hollywood to have Dancing with the Stars seat Roman Polanski as a judge." Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I totally agree with Michael. It's a big whoop. But that Christian news site, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
Well, we should move on to our final headline for this week, and one that I'm sure, Karen, you could care less about, because it's about Eat, Pray, Love. The Julia Roberts film got a gentler PG-13 rating after its filmmakers appealed to the Classification and Rating Appeals Board for the Motion Picture Association of America, which initially gave it an R rating for brief, strong language. So then what would they have given the MTV Movie Awards? That would have been, like, unwatchable. Like, half the show was bleeped out. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop? Never mind. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Karen?
Who cares? It should get this book was so bad, it should get G.
Michael?
And I say it's a big whoop, and for the first time in history, I think Karen and I have agreed on every single topic.
Oh my goodness. You must be tired. Jet lag.
Let's fight about something on Inside Baseball.
Right. We should move on to Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss only the stories that people in Hollywood might care about. And just as a little aside, here's a story that people only in Hollywood will care about. It turns out there will be no more costume superheroes in Hollywood. And I don't mean in movies. I mean on the streets of Hollywood, because apparently it appears the Los Angeles police have launched an effort to clear the area in front of Grauman's Chinese Theater of unlicensed Hollywood character impersonators, and they made a dozen arrests last week. And in recent years, some tourists and shop owners and me have complained that the costume characters had become more aggressive and pestered some of the tourists for money and tips. Arrests made over the past couple of days include, and this is a hefty lineup, you ready? Spider-Man, Catwoman, Batman, Scooby-Doo, a Johnny Depp lookalike playing Jack Sparrow, Elvis, another Catwoman, and a few others.
There must be some good YouTube video out there of this. I would love to see these people being hauled off to jail.
Oh, there is.
Oh, that's hilarious. We'll have to link to that on our YouTube site, Sperling.
Yeah, I'll try and find it.
What about War Machine? Was War Machine there?
No, War Machine was not there. And thank you, Michael, for bringing up our YouTube channel. I should encourage everybody to go to youtube.com/showbizsandbox, where we highlight all of the viral videos that we find, and including a few we make.
And that's why I live in New York, because they're never going to get my Spider-Man costume from me.
Okay, that's actually kind of frightening. And alrighty then. Moving on, I guess, to Lionsgate, or Miramax, two mini major studios that seem to be in flux these days. Lionsgate is in flux because Carl Icahn, the activist investor, is trying to take over with his incredible offer of $7 per share. Mind you, the stock is trading at like $7.04, so it's not exactly offering a premium. But he owns 19% of the stock. He wants to try and take it over because he believes Lionsgate's management is not doing a good job. Initially, he would have needed 50% of the stock to do so. He changed and amended his offer so that he will take anybody's stock at this point at $7 a share. And no matter how much he gets, if he gets, I think it's 33% of Lionsgate, he'll be able to oust the management. And if he gets 30%, he can block any major acquisitions that Lionsgate wants to do.
Why is this taking so long?
Because the management of Lionsgate, which has spent $6 million fighting this over the past couple of months, and by couple, I mean, I think this has been going on since last year. They are fighting this. Icahn is trying to take over the company through a proxy battle, and the management is telling all of the shareholders, do not sell your shares to Carl Icahn.
And because he will fire us.
He will fire us. And just in case they do, we're setting aside $16 million so that we have a little bit of a golden parachute. And of course, Icahn then lambasted them for setting aside money as a golden parachute. But what I find funny is it's $16 million for like two or three people. It's not Michael Eisner money. It's not Mike Ovitz money. This is $16 million. Mind you, I don't have $16 million.
Well, it's not as big a company, obviously.
Right. And so speaking of how big the company is, their fiscal year ended in March, and revenue was up 8% to $1.58 billion. And their net loss decreased 89% to $19.5 million. And their overhead expenses decreased 4% and were only $117.6 million. I mean, for a company that size to have an overhead of only $117 million, that's not bad. I don't know why Icahn is complaining.
Because their shares are trading at $7 a share.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's probably why he's complaining.
Well, at this point, it's probably just become a matter of winning.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I think he wants it for his son. His son would take over.
Oh, Joey God. Icahn?
Icahn Jr.
Okay. And what about Miramax? The Weinsteins are totally out of it now?
The Weinsteins are totally out of it, as we reported previously. And here's another one, Karen, that's taking forever. Disney, which owns Miramax Films, the company founded and once run by Bob and Harvey Weinstein. They put it up for sale last year. They wanted to get around $700 million for the Miramax name and the 611 film titles. And they got three bids. And despite the fact that the Weinsteins did not have the highest bid, they spent a month or so in exclusive negotiations with just the Weinsteins. And that fell apart 2 weeks ago while we were in Cannes. And so then they turned around to the other bidders, who were another group of brothers, Tom and Alec Gores, who are a group of brother investors, as well as Ron Tudor and the embattled financier David Bergstein, who have partnered up, and they've offered somewhere between $650 and $700 million. It turns out the Gores decided, you know what? We're going to move on. We're going to go try and buy the Starz Media, which owns Overture Films. You guys have fun with your little Miramax over there. And so that leaves Ron Tudor and David Bergstein, this guy who earlier this year, a group of creditors dragged him into court because several companies he controlled went into bankruptcy, and a judge appointed a trustee to oversee all of his assets. So he's saying, look, I'm just advising Ron Tudor. I'm not actually going to be an investor. Yeah, because he can't invest. No judge would allow, you know, the person overseeing his assets would not allow assets to flow.
So that's why he gets the adjective embattled in front of his name.
Yes, correct. So
and Ron Tudor is a construction guy.
Yes,
he's nothing to do with movies.
No, nothing to do with movies.
He's not like on the site and like, you know, building stuff.
No, he's like,
right, but I mean, he's never done anything in movies before. I wish people like that would just give me their money and I could tell them, yeah, it didn't work out, and sorry, have a nice day.
Because yeah.
They always end up sinking tons of money into movies and then walking away 5 years later with a barrel.
A barrel.
Yeah, and totally disillusioned, too.
Let's see, a barrel of money and then walking away with a barrel.
Not a barrel, baby. I mean, instead of their clothes, they get taken to the cleaners.
Oh, my God. Oh, my goodness. I totally
He's
did not.
Clever for somebody who hasn't been sleeping.
Exactly.
Haven't we always seen that over the years? People get suckered into sinking lots of money into some Hollywood property, and people like make their dream project about, you know, sheep herders in Oklahoma, and then make all the movies that nobody else will make for them that they've been peddling for years. These people who don't know what they're doing. Oh, it's Kevin Costner's dream project. It's Joey Blowey's dream project. And suddenly all their money's gone and they don't have any infrastructure. They don't have any library and they've lost their money.
But the producers are driving around in Porsches and Mercedes.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. These two guys actually live around the corner from me.
Ron Tudor?
Ron Tudor and David Bergstein live in Hidden Hills, which is very close to where I live. And I will say this, not to make
very it close, but worlds away.
I was going to say, they live behind the gate. They live in front of the gate. So that's why they can afford to make it a $650 million offer for Miramax, and I can just afford to talk about it.
At least he's buying a library, I have to say, because that's the only way you make money, ultimately. You got to have a library. So at least Ron Tudor's doing that.
Yeah, that's right. And speaking of libraries, if you want to listen to a library of all of our podcasts, you can find it on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. Or you can visit our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find the show notes for episode 57. That would be the episode you're listening to. And you can find links to all of the stories we talked about in the show notes. You can also find links to all of our social networking accounts, including that YouTube channel that we talked about, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, you name it. You'll also find ways to contact us. You can send us an email. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Send us your feedback, your comments, your well-actuallys, and we'll be more than happy to read them on the air. Same goes for voicemails. You can give us a call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That number again is 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each of our shows is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT. Their website is whoismgmt.com. Karen's website is KarenWoodwardOnline.com, and her Twitter account is @Karen_Woodward. I think I got it right for the first time.
You always get it right, Sperling.
Oh, okay. Michael is also on Twitter. Easy name to remember, Michael Giltz. @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. And if you want to visit his website and read all of his writing and whatnot, you can. MichaelGiltz.com. He made it really, really hard for you to do that. I made it even more complicated because you'll have to visit a website called CelluloidJunkie.com to read any of my writing. Or you can follow me on Twitter. My username is @Sperling. And until next week, play nice.